Jonathan Swift is best known as one of the greatest satirists in English literature, celebrated for works like Gulliver's Travels and A Modest Proposal. But his legacy extends far beyond his literary genius. As we'll hear tonight, he was a pioneer in fields like finance and also mental health care, bequeathing in his will the money to establish what is now St. Patrick's University Hospital, the leading institution in mental health care today. And we're looking at Swift's life this evening, just in time for the upcoming Jonathan Swift Festival, which runs from the 22nd to the 27th of November, with events taking place around Dublin City. And one of the venues is St. Patrick's Cathedral, which will host on Friday, the 22nd of November, Jonathan Swift, Savage Indignation, the life of Jonathan Swift told through interviews, drama and music. That's written and presented by Jerry Mullins, who joins me now. Also featured will be two other Swifties, different application of the name than normal, who are also with me in studio. Dr. Brendan Toomey is an historian and retired banker, and Professor Jim Lucy, Inspector of Mental Health Services at the Mental Health Commission. You're all very welcome indeed
to the History Show.
Jerry, there were two women, I'm sure there were plenty more, but two in particular in his life, both of whom were actually called Esther, but they're known by their names, Stella, or the name Stella and Vanessa, and you've learnt an awful lot about them in the last few months. Tell me about these two women and his relationship with them. Let's start with Stella.
Well, Stella was just a child when Swift met her, and he became her tutor. And from that initial connection, when they both lived in the same house in London, they ended up having a very, very long relationship, about 30 years. So it sounds a bit strange to kind of end up in a very long relationship with somebody you met when they were nine, but there's no suggestion of any impropriety in that situation. But to their friends all around them, everyone assumed that they were married, at least their closest friends did. But it begs the question, why did they not declare that they were married? And the current thinking is that they were actually very closely related in a very way that would cause them both embarrassment. In other words, it seems, we don't know for certain, it seems that both of them, their parentage were questionable, and they may have been uncle and niece. And it might have been at an advanced stage of the relationship before they found this out. So they developed a very, very close friendship. They wrote to each other all the time. One of Swift's most famous publications is actually called Letters to Stella. Mm. So when he was over working for the Conservative, first of all, he's worked with the Whigs. Later on, he worked with the Conservative government in England.
And he was a spin doctor.
He was a spin doctor. Yeah. Yes, he was the Alistair Campbell of his day. Very highly regarded and feared. And that's why Lord Bolingbroke hired him in, because he was originally a Whig, and then Bolingbroke brought him in as a Tory. And he admitted, we were afraid of you. We were afraid of your pen. Mm. So all those years he was in London, Stella was back here in Dublin, and he was writing to her constantly. And those letters eventually were formed and were published, and it was called Letter to Stella. Now, he didn't publish it, I should say, you know.
So it wasn't, you don't think it was a platonic relationship?
I don't. Now, nobody has got definitive proof in it, but I don't know if you can possibly be that close to somebody for so long and write these really nice poems to each other, very affectionate poems. It's hard. It's hard to imagine. I mean, even if it was platonic, it was certainly a very close relationship that didn't really have room for a third person in it.
But there was.
The plot thickens.
Okay. Yeah. Now tell us about Vanessa.
Right. So Vanessa. So while he was in London and Stella was in Dublin, sure, you know, a fella might get a bit lonely, right? And he befriended this family, and he actually became friendly with Mrs. von Homerigg. This is a family that had originally lived in Dublin, because the father of the family was actually a Lord Mayor of Dublin. They were a Dutch family. And when the father died, they ended up back living in England, and Swift became friendly with them. And he became friendly with the mother, the widow, in a platonic way. And I think more like a mother-son relationship. You know, she used to cook for him, and he used to leave his good wig and his good gown in the house. And you can imagine, even to this day, a bachelor living in a strange city, they kind of gravitate towards wherever they can get a free meal. And that was the relationship as it started off with Stella, because Stella was the daughter. She was still a teenager when this older gentleman was coming in to change his gown and change his wig and get a free dinner. And from there, a relationship started, which, again, like the one with Stella, was kind of a tutor-pupil relationship. He was very kind to her, very helpful to her, guided her. And from there, some kind of a relationship developed such that she thought that she would be marrying him. I think we can be fairly clear about that.
Yeah, there's no doubt about that. Yeah. She expected. She also became a poet. She her verse is not bad, which is amazing for a woman at that time with the privations that education would have would have limited a woman's access to education. So he clearly was somebody worthwhile being around because he shared his knowledge. And so a woman was emancipated by him.
I completely agree. Could you imagine having Jonathan Swift as your personal tutor?
Yeah,
I'd love that. That'd be great.
The cleverest man in the kingdom. That's what they say.
Yeah. Yeah. So, as you said there, Jim, like, I've been going through Stella's poems and they really are really nice. I've converted them to songs. We'll probably talk about that shortly. Vanessa's prose is really strong. Mm. When Vanessa writes a lacerating letter at you, you feel it.
Yeah. Right? You know all about it. That's very true.
You know all about it. There was nothing held back.
But, I mean, he did not necessarily share Vanessa's feelings towards him, or did he? Or
I think in London, the relationship was quite strong, and he was many years in London, and they were many years together in London. The problem started when he moved back to Dublin, when he lost his job. Like any spin doctor, once the government changes, you lose your job. Yeah. Almost within hours, right? Mm. So he lost his job. He took a consolation prize, which was the Dean of St. Patrick's. He didn't want a deanery of St. Patrick's. He didn't really want to come back to Ireland. He was hoping for maybe a similar position in England. That would have suited him down to the ground. But anyway, he was sent back to...
He was lucky to get it. Many of the Bolingbroke conspiracy, or they had been governed, went to the Tower. So he just had to go to Dublin.
True. Well,
if you remember, because he had done such great service, the pun was, we have to get a lean bishopric or a fat deanery for Dr. Swift. They were unashamed in their use of preferment, to use their euphemism. Yes.
But just to get back to the sex and the romance.
Okay, enough of this religion.
Vanessa decides that,
she's coming
Johnny,
back.
Johnny's back in Dublin. Yeah. I'm heading there as well.
Yeah. Now, there's various reasons for it. It was to do with her inheritance. She had to come here because the inheritance that she was due to get a big wad of cash. And the family owned a big, beautiful house in Selbridge called Selbridge Abbey, which is still there. Still a big, beautiful house, but it's kind of closed up. Mm. So she was from a rich family and she was due to inherit. And things were getting a bit messy back in Dublin. So she did have to come for that reason.
Right.
And she didn't really want to be in Dublin either. But he wrote to her, and it's quite clear in some of the letters, if you come to Dublin, I will see you seldom. He didn't want her to come, and she came anyway. And that then set the scene for a problem that was eventually going to arise, and it did arise.
How did that, Brendan, how did that all work itself out, the relationship with these two women who were both in Ireland at the same time as he was?
Well, it's very hard to say in some respect. As Jerry says, Swift said, I won't see you often. But clearly they did see one another quite a good deal when in those years. So you're talking 1714 to 1722 for this period. That's a long time. Mm. And they did see one another regularly, a bit surreptitiously. The back room of a bookshop is mentioned on more than one occasion.
How aware was each of the other?
Apparently, Stella was not aware, certainly at the beginning.
Of Vanessa.
Vanessa was obviously aware because everybody knew that Stella was, in inverted commas, the mistress of the house. When Swift was in his deanery and was holding a dinner party, Stella would be there doing the hostess duty. But she never stayed there.
And was there not a tabloid press in those days who would have been interested in the comings and goings of the Dean of St. Patrick, particularly a Dean of St. Patrick who was very political?
He was the tabloid press.
That's true.
He had the pen.
Well, there was a couple of things. Stella had her pal with her, Rebecca.
Yeah.
And so the two of them were always together. So the cover was that she was really there with her friend Rebecca. She didn't live with the Dean. They were certainly good friends. And also the Dean would have said, and everybody would have assumed, they were never alone together. Mm-hmm. It was never Stella and the Dean in the room at the same time. I don't really believe it.
Rebecca was the gooseberry.
Yes.
That's right. Yeah.
So it was totally respectable to have this woman hanging around with another woman. If she was just hanging around the Dean, it might be seen as being a different thing.
Mm. Or if she stayed overnight.
Or if she's known to have stayed overnight.
But the thing is, they did stay in the deanery when he was away, because like everybody else at the time, they rented rooms. And so he saved them a few bob. He says, you can have my gaff when I'm away, but the second I'm back, you're out.
Yeah. If you follow the money, Brendan, you follow the money. Yeah.
Jerry, this seems to be very, very unpromising material for a musical. But somehow you have managed to scrape a musical together out of this called Jonathan Swift, Savage Indignation. I mean, is there any point in asking you, looking at the cast list, for example, because Vanessa's there, Stella's there, and Swift is there, what the musical is about?
Well, I think we've described, we've given away half the story already.
Okay.
Well, I did
over in Ashka, we've done it. Okay, let's actually hear a snippet of what you can explain the origins of the title of the song and some of the lyrics. A snippet of one of the songs in the musical now. It's called Dash, Dash, Dash.
In London you wrote pamphlets and letters, often in secret so police couldn't see. You're famed for your works, your fabulous words, they matter. Except the words that matter most to me. Dash, 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 just say what you want to say. Dash, 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 please write what I want to see. No secretive code, like sipping my coffee. Please write words that mean something to me.
Right, that was Aisling Coleman as Vanessa, accompanied by David Munro on piano, singing Dash, 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 written by Jerry Mullins. Explain the significance of the dashes.
Mm. Well, can I say, first of all, that's a world premiere. I'd like to congratulate the History of the Show. You know, I'm reminded of when Chris de Burgh played his song for the first time on the Late Show.
It started on the History Show.
Exactly. So Swift was an incredibly secretive person. As we said earlier on, the two ladies in his life, their names were Esthers, but one he calls Stella and the other he calls Vanessa. And in his letters, he signs them off Cad to Vanessa. So he had these letters between Vanessa and Cad, neither of whom actually existed as people, you know, as people today, but not their names. So he was incredibly secretive. He was always afraid that his letters would be intercepted and find their way into the press. But also he felt his archbishop was opening his mail. So they had their secret code, and whenever they wanted to say something that was a little bit controversial, a little bit sexy or raunchy, they'd just write dash, dash, dash. And on top of that, sipping
Were you meant to guess what the dash, dash, dash suggested, or did it actually mean something?
No, there's no doubt. You could fill in the gaps.
I wish I was there to walk around your guard 20 times and then dash, dash, dash.
Right. We get it.
And on top of that, then, did another few phrases that were kind of part of a secret code, and the coffee kept coming up in the most arbitrary places, you know. I wish I was there with you right now, sipping your coffee. I've had no coffee since I last met you.
How could anybody have thought for 200 years that this might have been a platonic relationship?
Well, that's a good question. Now, I should point out, a lot of their letters weren't published for the first time until about 1921, if I remember correctly. So that's part of it. So anyway, so the couple of verses you just heard being sung by Aisling Coleman. So in London, he wrote pamphlets and letters, often in secret so police wouldn't see. Well, we know that the police were often hounding him. And at one stage, one of his printers got locked up in the tower, you know. And so that's when we get to dash, 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 just say what you want to say, dash, 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 just write what I want to see. No secretive code like sipping my coffee or sipping your coffee. Please write something to you. It means something to me. Can you imagine the frustration? You're dealing with one of the greatest writers in the world who's writing to you regularly. And this man who's been so controversial and he's slaying all his political opponents and other opponents right throughout the world, you know, with his words. And yet when it comes to writing you a love letter...
Dash, dash, dash.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Voltaire writes to Swift, not the other way around.
Absolutely. You know, that's right.
That's how famous he was.
Okay, let's stop the boring sex and romance and move on to more important elements of this, of the story of Jonathan Swift. Jim, his greatest legacy, in your view, is St. Patrick's.
It's certainly up there. It's not a footnote, as you know, Robbins or others would have said, a footnote to the history of healthcare. You know, really, just a sideshow among one of the greatest figures of English literature. It's much, much, much more than that. If you think of him as the man, let's say, leave the work aside. He was a contemporary of people. You know, Bishop Berkeley, whose name has been taken off Trinity College because of his commitment to slavery. Swift, commitment to human rights. this is way ahead. And not just in a sort of a smoked salmon way, you know, away at the, but in a practical way in which he was determined to deliver the proceeds of his views and of his talent to the service of other, in this case, other Irishmen and women. This was completely unprecedented. And so it is a pioneering thing to do. So I think a first is worthwhile mentioning. Mm. You know, this has not been done before. Now, he was with a group of people, Bishop Delaney, Dr. Stevens, you know, Griselle Stevens, you know, Bartholomew Moss. There was this extraordinary moment of great ascendancy figures who were contributing to human rights and to human. They mightn't have used the word human rights, but they certainly were Lockean. They were followers of that. They were not the believers of the brutal, nasty and short theory of what humanity was about. So he stands out amongst them, but within them he even stands out because his commitment was to mental health. So he had this fierce indignation was because he had views that today we would take for granted. This is 300 years ago. He believed Dr. Diet, Dr. Quiet and Dr. Merryman were the best doctors in the land. This is an invention of holistic healthcare that we think is as recent as last year. But no, 300 years ago, he was taking exercise. He was washing. He was entreating people to eat vegetables, to limit the amount of red meat. This is a really...
He himself consumed some pretty exotic fruits, didn't he?
He liked fruits. We mentioned the coffee. Of course, we're at a time now when of course, trade is opening up. These things were coming into Dublin and into London. So you could get coffee and you could get fine fruits and things. That hadn't been the case before. So there was that sense of being on the world stage. He also was committed to being in amongst the powerful. Cum magnus vix esse. He was prepared to sit with the great. And to negotiate with them. And he made that the motto of his life. And it references Erasmus, the great figures of the Renaissance. He saw himself at that level. But his purpose was for the human good. And he wasn't stuffy about it. If there was a table, you know, that old party game, who would you like to have for dinner with you? I want Swift. And everybody who knows me knows that. Yeah, I want Swift to come to dinner. Because he would have been wonderfully entertaining. He might have been savagely indignant, but he'd have been right on the right side of the argument.
And he would have made sure you washed your hands before.
He would have made sure you washed before and afterwards. And he would have taken exercise and been fit. He might have walked to the dinner. In the sense that no one else thought that those with mental affliction were worth any time. They were subhuman. He was remarkable. He argued this, though, from first principles. He says, you say the mentally ill are mad because they hold fixedly things that are false. But which of us does not hold fixedly things that are false? We all believe things to be true that are not. Therefore, the mentally ill are no different than ours. This was an emancipation of enormous proportion. Now, the fact that he then did another thing, Miles, he said, and he predicted it, he said he'd going to do it. He wasn't a spin doctor of falsehood. He spun, but he said in his own epitaph, you know, he said in the past tense, but in fact it was in the future tense, he gave all the wealth he had. Now, it turns out, to build a home for fools and mad, that was the term, and prove no kingdom, no nation needed so much. He had a national sense of Ireland. He's the first patriot, in a sense. He saw Ireland as a nation. And he saw the commitment to their afflicted as being the mark of a nation.
And did it have anything to do? Because, I mean, I always assumed that, and utterly naive, I know, and idiotic, but that's the reason why he contributed so much to St. Patrick's Hospital was because he went mad himself.
No, his successors... After all, after Queen Anne's gone, the Georgians come. It's very, very important that this man, who is really destructive, is diminished and is marginalised. And in fact, his commitment to mental illness is something that stigmatically happens even now. You know, we can dismiss him. His commitment was born out of experience, certainly. He was orphaned. His love of comfort, the comfort company of women, is very understandable for me as a psychiatrist. You know, there people took him in. And he was committed to it because of his experience in the Bedlam Hospital. He had been to the Bedlam Hospital in London, where he was a chaplain. The Bedlam was not a hospital. It was a zoo where those who were demented or deranged in some way were put on show. You paid to throw things at them. He was chaplain to those people. He saw that this was the wrong way. He had a deeply authentic commitment to mental illness.
One of the fascinating things about him also, Brendan, is the way his, you've looked at his finances and the way in which this hospital was financed, I think is quite extraordinary. But tell us about how he went about making money.
Well, two things. Firstly, the hospital, as Jim says, everybody knew that that hospital was on the way because he first announces it over 10 years before he dies. Well, about 1731, 32. It's regularly reported in the papers as he's getting it organised, putting the governors together. Now, how did he pay for it? Well, his will, he left £15,000 to the hospital. The rest of his will is just incidentals. You know, my favourite coat to this person, two medals to that person, etc. including some jokes. My second favourite hat, you know, sort of thing. But in those days, the Dean of St. Patrick's, they don't have a salary. They have rents and incomes to the person who has the job. That's why none of them retire. They die with their boots on. It's worth about £700 a year. That's, technically speaking, a shed load of money. That is 40 times the average industrial wage, in inverted commas. He was a good saver. He literally saved a third of his income. He gave away a third of his income and he spent a third of his income in round numbers. So by the time he dies, he has a fortune of £15,000. Now, it's not bank account. It's not gold coins. It's not shares. The bulk of it is a secured person-to-person loan on a mortgage on land. There are three major ones, and all three, if I could put my bank manager's hat on for a moment, are bad credit risks. They are not doing very, very well. If the inspectors came in nowadays, he would be dismissed as a lender, and the central bank would say you have to put more capital in to make sure that you can take the losses, you know, etc., etc. The last of the money that he bequeathed, the hospital got it in 1805. He died in 1745. It took them a long time to get their money back. But they did in the end. They didn't get all the interest. They got the capital back, but they didn't quite earn the interest on it. So that's where the money went. He had appointed a set of governors and they got on with the job. The building starts, Jim, you'd probably know this better than me, only about 4 years after he died.
Only 4 years. Yeah. And I think it was really public sentiment was so great. Yeah. There was Dean Craddock was his successor, could not leave this undone. Mm. It had been talked about for so long and they knew the fortune was there. And so it had to be done. And the compromises were made, as you know. But a huge achievement.
Yeah. The reason we know all of this, of course, is because the governors of the hospital got all the paperwork to do with his finances. Yeah. And that's where I've been using to explore.
Tremendous resource.
It is tremendous resource.
He was very specific about where he wanted the hospital to be located and also how it should be run, Jim.
Yes, he had a...
The bylaws were set up even before he died.
Bylaws were set up, many of which, and I come to one of them that is always amused me, but we, you know, the hospital ran by, you know, when we achieved independence, all these had to be changed just by charter. But they were, but that was all. The content would stay the same. He was very concerned about the site. The Dublin burghers were very keen to make him commit the money to the building of it in Smithfield, where the Bluecoat School went. And he wasn't happy with that site. And so he never agreed on an ideal site. Dr. Stevens and Griselda, who was alive then, gave to the developers the site, which is at the back of Dr. Stevens Hospital. It's on a slope, it's on the Camac, it was a malarial swamp. It's just not a good place to be. Now it turns out to be the ideal place to have a mental health service that serves the city. It is smack bang in the community, by a train, by, you know, by the Lewis. But on the other hand, at that stage, it was a very poor plot within the Liberties. And so they had to make compromises. They built the corridors for the Collini and the Bucoli parallel, whereas traditionally, subsequently, they would have been out with each other. He laid down charters that were very much of their time, but they were hugely wise. One of the ones that used to always amuse us, and occasionally I'd be reminded of it in jest, was that the director of medicine, or it wouldn't have been called that, the chief clinician of some kind, should not form too close a personal relationship with the director of nursing.
Very wise.
And this is a man who knew the goings-on with coffee in the back room of a library. And he understood that these things happened in hospitals. And he was tremendously generous and humane. He never lost the practical realities of human beings.
But there's one other element to it. He was a churchman. And yet he wanted this hospital to be non-sectarian.
He was a church. He gave the lands that became the Foundling Hospital. That's James's. He gave the lands that became the Meath Hospital.
Right.
It was his vineyard, and that became the county hospital. Mm. He was extremely concerned that this should not be, and he laid it down. So they couldn't, for example, if you compare the Rotunda, which is another wonderful legacy of philanthropy and national patriotism from Bartholomew Moss, it has in the centre of it a chapel. Every Dublin, everybody to visit Dublin should go and see it, with the ornate ceiling and the magnificent bas relief. There's none of this in Patrick's. Why? He did not want it to be a sectarian hospital. It was to be open to everyone. This is visionary. Mm. Now, he was a little bit iffy about Presbyterians. He
was more than a little bit.
Everybody likes, everybody who likes Swift minimises foibles. He described Presbyterians as fanatics. But they still were admitted. If they needed to be. Unfortunately, his vision was never realised. Within months of the hospital opening, the financial model, which depended on realising all these monies, was not sustained. And so they started taking paid patients.
Just to talk about Brendan, his relationship, I mean, he didn't particularly want to come back to Ireland. He was comfortable in London. But then how does that square with one of the most famous quotes that everybody knows from Swift? Ireland would never be happy till a law were made for burning everything that came from England except their people and their coals. And I think subsequently he says that, and I'm not so sure about the first one. Words to that effect. So what was his relationship with England?
Well, first of all, he's a satirist. You know, Swift is always good fun that way. I always say to students and people, read the sentence before and the sentence after.
It's
always good advice. When he came back to Dublin, he says, you know, in a forlorn hope, he says, and I am never going to get involved in Irish politics. He says this in 1714. And he keeps his word for about 5 years.
Mm.
And he comes out eventually with the Irish Manufacturers, which has that famous quote, which gets his printer into trouble. Because what we've got to recognise is, in our internet age, that was anonymous.
Mm.
But everybody knew who wrote it.
Mm.
So the only way...
As was Drapier's letters, which was about Woods Hapens, also anonymous.
And Drapier was one of his pseudonyms. Everybody knew.
Yeah. But the only way the government could get after somebody is by arresting the printer. So the printer gets arrested. Waters in the first case, Harding in the second. And shall we say the judge tries to strong arm the jury into convicting. And the burghers of Dublin, the brave burghers, 9 times they are sent out to come back with a guilty verdict, and 9 times they come back and say, no, we can't see any guilty verdict here. That was in 1720. The reason Swift gets so upset is a thing called the Declaratory Act, which is where the British government get tired of what they called independency in the Irish political elite. And they enact an act, 294 words. They don't waste any words in it. And they simply say, we're the boss, and the British House of Lords is the only place you can go to have an appeal.
Yeah.
Swift hated this. That was the proximate cause for writing the Manufacturers. So he and his mates were spoiling for a fight, and along comes Wood, where they're going to issue all this copper coin to Ireland. The main issue is nobody consulted them. So they had this fit of high indignation. And to be fair, Swift isn't the leader of the campaign. Many of his colleagues are the leaders. Swift joins it about halfway through it with the Drapier's letters. The word Drapier is, I always believe, a Dublinism.
Mm.
Because when you look up the sources, the word never appears before 1724. The proper word is Draper. So he issues the letters and we have a repeat performance of 1720. Their printer gets arrested. There's another court case.
Mm.
But they win. In fact, there are 3 Drapier's letters that were not published at the time. We were at a seminar only recently where we were discussing that. They were only published about 10 years later. Because they didn't need to be published at the time because the campaign worked.
Was he, though, a progressive? I mean, we think of him, because of all this political activity, as being a very progressive figure. Was he progressive?
Can I be my word of German on this? Jein, ja und nein. On some things, yes. On other things, no.
My view is that over time he becomes more progressive, the more he reflects on these things, the more he looks at the colonialism issue, the stronger his anti-colonial texts become.
And the more he looks at the poverty around him.
Indeed. Exactly. Part of that. Well, as you know, then that gives you the modest proposal in 1729. And he's casting this against his own type, his own tribe, because it's the landlords that are racking the rent. As he puts it in the modest proposal, he basically says, well, sure, they might as well have the children. They've got everything else.
And fricassee them, sell them to the Americans. Yeah. I mean, it's a great joke.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I think progressive is interesting. He absolutely is progressive, in my view. I'll give you two areas where he is. One is in religion. The three men in the tub are the three leaders of the great religions. And in Gulliver, the pomposity, the self-righteousness, the phoniness of the educational and political leaders of the time is
shown
up.
The big Endians and the little Endians.
The big, they're all shown up. And then in terms of his commitment to the mentally ill, that's a really, really remarkably progressive thing. Unprecedented and unparalleled since then. You could say Henry Hutchinson Stuart gave a great deal and was a great philanthropist 100 years later. But no philanthropist in the history of Ireland, no rich person has given all the wealth they had to a cause such as the mentally ill.
Okay. All of this and a lot more, I'm sure, will be teased out during the Jonathan Swift Festival, which runs from the 22nd to the 27th of November with events around Dublin City. Go to jonathanswiftfestival.ie for more information. And the event Jonathan Swift Savage Indignation takes place at St. Patrick's Cathedral on Friday, the 22nd of November at 8 p.m. You can hear all of our guests and you can hear that song dash, dash, dash all over again. It's the life of Jonathan Swift told through interviews, drama and music, presented by Jerry Mullins and featuring interviews with Jim and Brendan, as well as Cathy Scuffle, and music from the choir of St. Patrick's Cathedral. So to my guests this evening, Jim Lucy, Brendan Toomey and Jerry Mullins, thank you very much indeed for joining us.
Thank you, Miles.
Thank you.